Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. Moksha, freedom, liberation. Most of us think about it as something that happens after we die. But as Pujya Swamiji always reminds us, it's right here. It's not something we're going to get after we die if we didn't get it here. The chains that bind us, because of course the opposite of liberation and freedom is to be stuck, to be in jail, to be bound. Liberation from what? Freedom from what? Moksha from what? The chains that bind me. It's not liberation from the body itself. The body is not that which binds us. What binds us is the stuff that goes on in our head. What binds us is the games of the ego. What binds us is the concept of me as separate from you, which gives rise to everything ranging from anger to jealousy, to competition, to judgment, and which leads to me wanting to live for me or for my close ones, my immediate family, people I consider mine. And this is what leads to all of the problems. If I get it, or my immediate family gets it, all is good. But if I don't, and someone else has something, I'm miserable. When I see myself as an object, the body, the identity, and I therefore see others also as objects, identities, the problem with that becomes that I'm never able to actually connect. Two objects cannot connect. Two souls can connect. And so if I am identifying as a 45-year-old white female from America, sannyasi, approximately this high, if I identify as that, this degree, this upbringing, this family. If I identify as that, then all of that which I'm going to do is going to be to improve that. So I've got a bank account, I want it to have more. I've got a body, I want it to be prettier, healthier. And then I identify others in the same way. And this creates distance between us. And so what's important to look at is, what is it that's binding me? And for most of us, it's not very vague. For most of us, it actually is very specific. Our egos, our expectation, how other people should be, how something should be in our family, how something should be in our workplace, how something should be in our community. We almost never have expectations that kill us of the random guy down the block. It's always of those right around us. And those expectations, those ego issues, whether it's family, whether it's workplace, whether it's close community, That's the stuff that kills us. Why this person got to be president of the association instead of me. I've been working so much harder. I'm so much more dedicated. They took 100 rupees out of the cash box last year. They should have been fired. Forget, how did they possibly get be made president? Why am I always the one who has to do more work than other people? Why am I always the one who gets the short end of the stick? All of this stuff is actually what kills us. And so when we talk about moksha, it's freedom from that. It's freedom from the idea that there is something very specific that I am supposed to get or have or feel in this life. And because of you or you or you, I am not getting it. You are the object obstacles between me and the happiness or the success or the love that I am supposed to have. These are the chains. And so the real moksha is to understand that whatever form we may be in, whatever body, whatever identity, whatever history, whatever situation, what we are is vessels for God's flow. And how can we let go of all of the stuff that's binding us? Because I'll tell you something. Let's imagine for a moment that you and I were holding two ends of a string over here. Okay? Now you're pulling on your end, I'm pulling on my end. And this is what happens usually in relationships. We think, well, why should I do something? Look, she's pulling over there. She should let go. And if she doesn't let go, nothing's gonna change. But the amazing thing is, if I let go of my end, even if you keep pulling, even if you never let go, 100% of the tension in the string automatically goes away. That's the moksha. Is I don't need you or you or you to act in a certain way for my inner well-being. Mere jo swastiti is not dependent on paristiti. I am bound as long as jese paristiti vese miristiti. Then I'm stuck. But if my inner being is not dependent on the outer world, then I'm not wasting my time and energy trying to change the outer world so that I can be happy, so that I can be peaceful. That's the real freedom. Is to be able to be in the midst of how people are living and what they're doing, recognizing that everybody comes onto this earth with a different karmic package. And each of them is just enacting out their own karmic package. And none of us is the karmic police in charge of each other's karmic packages. We're only in charge of ourselves. And the question is, you may be in jail because of what you've done to me. And this is true. If somebody hurts you, if somebody acts out of abuse, betrayal, cheating, they're going to get the karmic results of that. That's how the law of karma works. They're already in jail. But my question to myself is, do I want to sit in jail with them? They're already getting the fruits of their karma. Their karmic package is unfolding. The other important piece to keep in mind is that everybody comes into this world and moves through this world with what I call a toolbox. And in any situation, I can only respond to that situation based on the tools I have in my toolbox. So if I come upon a wall and there's a nail in the wall, well, I can tell what the most effective and skillful way to handle this situation is to get a hammer and hammer in the nail. But if in my toolbox there is no hammer, if all I've got in my toolbox is a toothbrush and a spoon, then I'm going to whack at the nail and not be able to get it in. I won't be skillful in that moment. And in situations in life, when our life situations require people around us to have patience, to have compassion, to have generosity, to have love, and they don't, and instead they have anger, or frustration, or impatience, or fear, or confusion, or abuse, it's because that's all they've got in their toolbox. Just as I cannot hammer in a nail if I don't have a hammer, they cannot respond with patience if all they've got in their toolbox is anger and frustration. So when we really understand that, and then we allow ourselves to just be vessels for God's will to flow. Recognizing, okay, God, it's not me, it's you. You've put me here. Help me know what you want from me. Help me just be a vessel through which your will can flow in this situation. Get my will out of here. It's not working. I've been trying, whether for months or for years. For most of us, it's been years. I've been trying. It's not working. Now you flow through me. And then, yes, living here, not running off to the jungles. Absolutely. There are many, many who have attained it. It's not easy. Giving up our egos is not so easy. Giving up our identities, the stuff we hold on to, is not so easy. But it's absolutely doable. And it's just as doable here as sitting in a cave. But you have to just let go of the string from your side, knowing that that's in your hands.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM-FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. What is this bhakti yoga? What is devotion? And what is the purpose? It's something that when you're steeped in that world, you forget almost that might be a question. Devotion or bhakti, love. But that full love, the love that's not asking anything in return. Devotion is not about what are you going to do for me. So many times these days in most of our relationships, they become give and take. They become 50-50. It becomes, I love you when you are doing what I want you to do, speaking the way I want you to speak, treating me the way I want you to treat me, then I love you. But miraculously, no matter how much I may profess my undying, unconditional, eternal love for you, the minute you're no longer doing what I want or acting the way I want, I no longer am able to access that love. I shout, I criticize, I insult, I sulk and walk into the other room. Whatever it is, whatever my reaction may be, they are reactions that are the opposite of love and connection. So devotion is that love which doesn't ask for anything in return. Devotion is that love that loves just to love. So devotion is that love that is its own reward. It's not, I love you so that I will get this, or I love you so that I will feel like that. But in devotion, the love is its own reward. Just loving you is in and of itself that juice, that ras, that essence of life. Which is why practices of devotion or bhakti yoga, whether it's singing, whether it's praying, whether it's doing puja, whatever it is, could be gardening, could be cooking. Because that yoga, remember, yoga is union. And so what are we uniting with? We're uniting with God. But as we speak about so frequently in here, God is infinite, which means that your bhakti yoga doesn't have to be focused on a specific image of God or a specific statue or a particular name. Bhakti yoga is any way in which you connect through love to the divine. It can even be with another person. As long as what you're loving is essence, you're loving God. You may think you're loving this person, but if what you're loving is the essence of who they are, not just their body, but really their soul, then what you're loving is God. You're just loving God in this form, or God in this form, or God in this form. So there's no rule in bhakti yoga about which form of God or which name of God it has to be. But that devotion, that love, is what brings real meaning in our life. There's a beautiful story from Hanumanji, who is the epitome of devotion. We chant the Hanuman Chalisa every night to instill in us that devotion, that ras, that essence, that juice. So there's a beautiful story about how at the end of the Ramayana, the end of the war of Lanka, rather, after Sita Ma has been rescued and Lord Ram has been victorious. We won't go into all of those details. But at the end of this war of Lanka, in which Hanumanji was the hero, the end of it, Sita Ma gives him this beautiful pearl necklace. And she says, now Hanuman, these pearls are very, very precious. Be very careful with them. This is a special gift for you, for the hero you've been, how you saved me. So she gives Hanumanji this pearl necklace, and he proceeds to take the beads one by one, and he looks at them from the top and from the bottom and from the left and from the right. And then he puts them in his mouth one by one and bites them. Remember, Hanumanji is in the form of a monkey, so he's very good with the mouth and the teeth. And he puts it in the mouth and bites it and then spits them out onto the ground. And Sitaji watches as he does this pearl by pearl by pearl. Finally, she can't take it anymore. And she says, Hanuman, what are you doing? I've told you that this pearl necklace is very, very precious. You're biting them, you're spitting them on the floor. What are you doing? And he says, Sitama, I'm looking for my Ram in these pearls. Because you said they're precious. And if they're precious, then it means Ram is in the pearls. God. For Hanumanji, God was in the form of Lord Ram. So I'm looking for God. If they are precious, my Lord Ram is in them. And if Lord Ram is not in them, then they're worthless. Then what do you mean they're precious? And it's such a beautiful, beautiful lesson in devotion. Because when you're really devoted, again, by any name, any form, it doesn't matter what your religion is, but when you're really devoted to the divine, whether in some divine form, whether in the form of humanity, whether in the form of nature, whether in the form of your child or your mother or the tree in your backyard or your grandmother, doesn't matter. As I said, if what you're loving is essence, you're loving the divine. So when you're really, really devoted, where that beloved is, everything is. And where that beloved is not, it doesn't matter how expensive, how sparkly, how beautiful the necklace may be. If my beloved is not there, they're worthless. And this is really the essence of devotion. Is all of that which I really want in life comes from loving you, comes from being connected to you. And the reason that it's usually, of course, for God is because our love for each other is usually conditional. Love for a fallible human being is typically conditional. As I said in the beginning, they do what we want, they act like we want, they speak like we want, they treat us like we want, we love them. They don't, we don't. But God, again, any name, any form, that infinite spirit, that love. And when we speak so frequently in satsang and in spiritual programs about detachment, viragya, people tend to think that this detachment is a lack of caring. Oh, I'm learning to be detached. Sometimes somebody will walk into satsang and they'll say, so I'm on this path of detachment. I'm getting very, very good. My viragya is very, very good. My children fell sick, I didn't care. I'm able to walk by the homeless people and it no longer bothers me. And I'm really, 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 really detached. Well, that's not the meaning of detachment. It's not that we stop caring. It's not that we take that God-given compassion and love and somehow turn the knob off. What it is Vairagya is actually the child of bhakti. In the scriptures, these virtues are personified, and so bhakti was actually a being. Vairagya was a being. And bhakti gave birth to Vairagya, which makes us know that that detachment comes through devotion to God. Because when I'm connected to the divine, when I'm really in love with the divine, with spirit, then these small little things that used to bother me, my desires, my ego, my fears, my longing, my temptations, all the stuff that we're looking to detach from, automatically it loses its hold on me because I've become reattached to the divine. And so the fruit of this devotion is being immersed in love for the divine, with the divine. It's a place in which, you know, usually you have the lover, the beloved, and love. But in bhakti yoga, that union brings the lover, the beloved, and the love into one. So there's no longer any separation. We have in India these two paths, the non-dualistic path, the path of Advaita, that says everything is God. There is nothing but God. There cannot be a lover or a beloved because there's no separation. It's all God. And then we have the dualist path where we have the lover and the beloved. But on that path, all of the bhakti yogis, we all know that at the highest level, at the deepest, truest level, of course it's all God. Of course it's all God. Of course we're all one. And yet, being in love is so beautiful and feels so good and is the path to everything else, all of the happiness, all of the peace, all of the joy in life comes from that love. And so, yes, on the highest, most intellectual awareness level, I can tell you, yes, it's all God. But being in love with God, being able to have this bhakti yoga, is so beautiful and is, as Bhagavan Krishna speaks about in the Bhagavad Gita, such a beautiful path to connect with God. So that's where it comes from. But on the last point about this, when we speak about bhakti yoga, we also speak about jnana yoga, the path of wisdom, karma yoga, the path of action. I'm not going to go into them in detail, but it's important to mention that the paths are not actually separate. They're three faces of the same love. You can begin anywhere. It doesn't matter. But you always, if wherever you begin it's real, you end up with the other two. So if you begin, for example, with Jnana Yoga, the path of wisdom, well, the more you learn about God, God inside you, God outside you, the more you love. And the more you love, the more you want to serve. When you love someone and they're sick in bed, or even if they're not sick in bed, you love to bring them breakfast in bed. You love to bring them things to take care of them, to surprise them with chocolates, flowers, whatever it is. We do these things because we love. So You can begin anywhere of the three, and it'll take you into all of them. It'll take you into that union of yoga. So don't worry which comes more easily. For many of us, the path of love and devotion comes more easily. For others, the path of knowledge comes more easily. For others, the path of service comes more easily. But don't worry. They'll bring you to that union of all three of them, to that sangam, that confluence of all three of them.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. Is 99% of our thoughts being useless, is that everybody? It's not everybody, but it's most of us. And the two things that determine that are what we call, in the psychological realm, nature and nurture. Nature being what I come into this world with, so you could call it your karmic package. Some people's nature just tends to be much calmer, even from birth. These two may look alike, but I'm sure if you talk to their mom and dad, they could tell you all kinds of differences in their personalities. So we come into this world with a karmic package. On a scientific level, they're going to call it genes. We call it karma. Either way, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter which way you go at it. But what we know is that we come into the world with a seed. And that seed is of something. Could be an apple seed, could be a peach seed, could be an oak tree seed. That's what we come in with. Whether due to our genes, whether due to our karma, whether due to some interaction of both of them. A piece of that nature determines not just our outer personality, but also that sense of overactivity of the brain. There are people who just by nature are more easygoing. I mean, we all know this. We all know people who it doesn't matter what happens. Oh, it's okay. It's okay. My dad is one of those people. He's never meditated. He would tell you he didn't even believe in God. But his nature is something that people meditate for 40 years to get to. It's just, it's his nature. And then we've got nurture. And nurture is all of the things that happen to us in the world, the environment in which we're raised. And it's not all what happens to us. A lot of it is the choices we make as well, of course. We are a co-creator of our own destiny. So whether it's educational aspects, whether it's relationship aspects, whether it's what our parents were like, there's 101 different things that come into play determining the general peace or unrest of our own mind. So it's not everyone, but it's most people. Even people who are generally peaceful people, when they start to meditate, there isn't actually this direct connection that we would assume there'd be a direct connection that someone is more peaceful, therefore it's easier for them to meditate. Not always. They may have a very active mind, but the mind is just not disturbing them. It's not going in the direction of harassing them. But it still may be overactive. It still may be just as useless. So it's not everybody, but it's, I think if we took a poll and we said, okay, you know, imagine that you've got a camera or a recorder in your mind and it's actually recording all of your thoughts, you'd have to really look at it for a few minutes, because most of us, if you've never looked at your thoughts, most of us would say, oh no, I only think useful thoughts mostly. And this is the first thing that happens in meditation, is you realize, oh my God, really? Wow. One of the first meditations that I started doing actually was a meditation in which I literally just turned my awareness into my brain. It was just a deliberate sense of taking my awareness and saying, okay, you want to keep running at this speed? Fine. I'm just going to watch you do it. And I turned my awareness literally just upward. I mean, I could picture myself looking at my brain from the bottom up and watching it think. And two things happen. First of all, you realize how absolutely useless that which goes on is. But the second interesting thing that happens is, as you start watching it, it actually stops. It's an amazing phenomenon. It'll run like crazy until you're watching it. And even if in that watching you're not saying, stop, shut up already, you're just watching it. The simple act of watching it actually makes it slow down. The one in us that says, stop, shut up, enough, actually makes things worse. In our international yoga festival, we set up these tents in the back garden for extra venues. And I was teaching meditation in there a couple of years ago in one of the tents, and in the afternoon, and all of these monkeys, because of course in the afternoon we get even more monkeys in the garden, they all jump on the top of the tent. And you can hear them, and if you look up, you can actually see the shadow of the monkey. And every once in a while, one of them would figure out how to stick an arm or a leg through a little opening in where the cloth was sewed together in the top of the tent. And it was distracting, of course, but we were able to keep meditating. It was just a little bit of noise on the roof. But then after about 5 minutes of that, the guard who had been put there to keep the monkeys away grabbed his stick and started banging on the metal poles of the tent to get the monkeys off the roof. Now that's when you no longer can meditate. when the guard is banging on the poles in the tent that you're trying to meditate in, that's when you have to just stop and say, okay, now this is what's happening. But the reason I mention it is it was a beautiful demonstration, and I actually was so thankful it happened, because this is what happens in our own meditation. Our thoughts come like the monkeys. They bounce around. They do their useless nonsense thing, and it's kind of annoying, slightly distracting. But with enough attention and focus and practice, you actually really can meditate despite that. But the minute that the inner guard starts doing its metaphoric banging of the stick against the pole, get out, stop thinking. You're supposed to be meditating. Go away, stop, shut up. That's when you've just ruined your meditation. So we acknowledge that the thoughts are there, but we don't hook our awareness into them. A good metaphor to think about is if you're watching the blue sky, you're lying on your back, the sunshine, looking up at the sky, and it's mostly a blue sky, so a few little clouds, and it's a windy day. And the clouds are blowing across your awareness. Now, you've got two choices every time a cloud comes. Either you hook your awareness onto the cloud and you follow it from this part of the sky over here. That's one option. Option two is you hook your awareness into the blueness of the sky. And you stay focused on the blueness of the sky, and the clouds just pass. And in meditation, when the thoughts come, rather than hooking our awareness into them and following them across our consciousness, and then we find ourselves 10, 15 minutes later somewhere that we wonder, how in the world did I get here? I was supposed to be meditating. Instead of that, focus your awareness on whether it's the breath, whether it's the mantra, whether it's a candle, whether it's an image, whatever it is you are meditating upon, whatever meditation technique you are using. Keep the awareness on that. And the thoughts will come, they'll just blow across. But they won't pull you out of your meditation. And then slowly, 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 what you'll find is that you actually become much more of a master of your mind than a slave of the mind. You still have thoughts, but they no longer run the show. And they no longer run so quickly. There develops a stillness in the mind such that thoughts become much more deliberate, rather than just running crazy all over the place. Might as well rehave a conversation we had that hurt us. Yeah, why not replay it over and over as we drive to work? We have nothing else to think about. Why not plan for the conversation that we're terrified is going to happen? We have it already in our minds over and over. This is what people do. This is the useless nature of the mind that I was talking about. And when you start meditating, what'll happen is when you drive or you're eating food or whatever you're doing, the mind has some place to go. Whether it goes into just awareness, spaciousness, a mantra, mindfulness, whatever word you want to use, it goes there instead of into the uselessness. But it's a practice. It's training the mind, literally.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin, with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. You've mentioned already a great one, the breath. For those of you who don't practice this, this is a personal favorite. Just bring the awareness back to the breath. But it has to be low in the abdomen. So you're actually grounding and rooting yourself into yourself. Other tips. You're interacting with someone. Well, let's say that what that person is doing is troubling me. It's annoying me. Maybe she's yelling at me. Maybe she's criticizing me. Maybe she's telling me 100 things that I've got to, you know, do for her, whatever it is. It's disturbing me. When I look at her, I have two ways of looking at her. I can look at the form, which is the vehicle from which the words are coming that are going into me and creating this sense of disturbance. Or I can look at her as me. Because remember when we say it's all soul, it's all consciousness. I mean, these are not just platitudes or, you know, trite phrases that we throw around in satsang but really don't have any meaning in regular life. Yes, it's hard to live like that all the time, but that's no reason to throw the practice out the window. So when I'm looking at someone and I'm interacting, whether it's somebody checking me out in line at a store, whether it's someone I'm having a difficult interaction with, whether it's someone I'm having a beautiful interaction with, instead of seeing them as separate, as them, as that separate form, can I see them as me? Can I see me in there? Can there be a recognition? And if I can't see me in there, can I at least see the divine in there? That same divinity that in my meditation I'm connecting with in me. We all understand intellectually that God wouldn't play favorites, that God would not say, oh, well, okay, I'll be in you, but not in you. And that if I've had any sort of an awareness of the divinity within myself, by definition, that means I have to at least acknowledge intellectually that the divine is in others, unless I believe that somehow I was born so special that God said, all right, I'm going to come in you, but forget everybody else. So by definition, I have to accept that the divine is in all. Can I try to see it? Can I use that interaction, rather than focusing on the waves of sound that are coming out of her mouth and you know, hitting against the tympanic membrane in my ear and that are going to cause now stress in my brain. Rather than that, can I see consciousness in her? Can I see love in her? And maybe if you want to take it a step earlier, so okay, highest goal is I see me in her. Total recognition that it's all God, it's all consciousness, we are one. On the way to that, I just see divinity in her. I may not be able to connect it with the divinity in me yet, but at least I see it in her. Before that, how about I see her story? Her toolbox. Because a lot of times what happens is we're having an interaction with someone. And it's difficult, it's challenging in a lot of ways. They're hurting us in one of 100 different types of possible ways, creating pain, creating stress, creating longing in me. Instead of that, can I look at where it's coming from? And I don't mean psychoanalyze at all. But instead of me feeling the anger or me feeling the frustration, can I see the anger in her with an awareness that if I'm feeling it, it's coming from her? And if she's generating it, it means that that's all she's got in her toolbox at this moment, because nobody wants to generate anger. I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I know what I'm going to do today. I'm going to be just a horrible person. I'm going to hurt as many people as I can. I'm going to be as annoying and obnoxious as I can. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says that. We're all pretty much doing the best we can. But we're doing the best we can with the different toolboxes that we have based on our nature and nurture package. And so can I see in her, instead of obnoxiousness, instead of meanness, instead of whatever I'm seeing in her, can I see fear? Can I see confusion? Can I see her longing? Her sadness. So what we start to look at is we shift from looking at form to looking at essence. And then we connect with that. So it gives me the opportunity in everyday interactions to actually be connecting with the divine, regardless of what I'm doing. And if you're stuck in traffic or the subway or whatever, see whether you can see the divine in that. It's not easy. It's really not easy. But as in the line from the Upanishads that I gave earlier, it's been given to us in the scriptures. Every single thing in the universe is pervaded by the divine. Which means if I can't see it, it's me. So can I make that my practice? Can I really see the divine in everything? I recommend you begin with people you love and things like trees and puppies. Work your way up to the difficult people in your life. You start in things that are easier. See God in a tree than to see God in, you know, someone you're having a fight with. Someone who's troubling you. But eventually you'll get there. Because that becomes the habit. That becomes literally your MO. How do I operate in the world like this? I'll try to see God. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.